Penguin Random House Audio presents Mr. Nobody. This is the author, Catherine Stedman. If the car crashed at this speed, the impact wouldn't be enough to kill us instantly, which you might think is a good thing, but it's not. The one thing worse than dying on impact is not quite dying on impact. Trust me, I know, I'm a doctor. And now that I'm thinking about it, I'd be genuinely surprised if this rental car even has airbags. Sparkling, snow-covered fields hurtle past. White, dusted hedgerows, sheep, ruts and ditches. The background of my childhood. A winter blur of pastoral England. Crisp sunlight, high in a rich cobalt sky. I flash a look to the driver, face locked in concentration as the brakes squeal me change down a gear, grinding into another blind corner. All I can do is will us on, and hope we make it on time. Before my patient does something. We accelerate out of the bend, the drag of it pulling us sideways, perilously close to the narrow lane's forest-lined edges. I let the imagined consequences of a car crash flash through my head. I see the fragile sweetmeat of our neocortexes smashing forward at 100 miles per hour into a quarter of an inch of solid skull bone. I hear the thick, packed meat sound of our heads connecting with the dark matte-grey plastic of the dashboard, and then instantly whiplashing back into our headrests with blunt force. A double cranial impact. War on two fronts. The reason armies get defeated. That delicate grey matter that we all take for granted. The part of our bodies that makes us, us. All that we are, crashing forwards and backwards at high velocity into the back of our own skulls. Frontal, parietal, and occipital blunt force trauma. Massive hemorrhaging. Internal bleeding, bruising, and atrophy. Dead tissue. The brain damaged beyond repair. Who we were. Gone. And then a new thought tops those terrifying images. Even if we somehow manage to survive all that, I'm probably the only person who'd be able to fix us afterwards. I'm the only doctor with relevant clinical experience in a 100-mile radius. The irony smarts. We swerve tight round another bend, branches jab into the broken window next to me, and I dodge further into the car. I need to focus. I squeeze my bleeding fist hard, letting the pain thunder through me. Focus. No more mistakes. This is all my fault. Everything that's happened. I could have stopped all of this if I'd only done better. Looked harder, if I'd picked up on certain things, if I'd seen the signs. My eyes flick up to the road ahead of us. I see it fast approaching on the horizon. The lay-by. The path that leads directly down to the sea. That wild expanse of water. That's where he'll be. If we're not too late. There was another time, long ago, when I wasn't focused. I missed the signs then too, and I let something very bad happen. But not this time. I promise. This time will be different. So different. This time I will stop something awful from happening. I will fix it this time. And if I'm brutally honest with myself, perhaps this is exactly what I've always wanted it to come to. A chance to fix things this time around. I mean, nobody becomes a psychiatrist by accident. Chapter 1. The Man. Day 1. The bright glare of light as the soft skin of two eyelids part. A body sprawled on the sand. The fast flicker of eyelashes as awareness blossoms within, and then just like that, he's awake. Consciousness floods through him. He feels the skin of his cheek pressed against the brittle cold of the beach. Confusion. Sounds of the sea. Waves crash and pull back. The pop and shh. It's early morning in January. A British beach in the depths of winter. Miles of golden white Norfolk shore sand, with the crisp dawn light throwing everything into high definition. Windborne sand grains blow in architectural ripples across the flats, straight into the man's unprotected face. He squeezes his eyes shut against the sting of it. A hot throb of pain crests deep inside his skull, and the papery skin around his eyes creases deeper, his forehead puckering as he flinches from it. The unanticipated pang lengthens, stretching itself inside his head, almost too much to take. A sharp gasp of breath and the pain stabs back harder, his hot exhalation of breath drifting away in the cold sea wind. He tries to relax into the pain, letting the wave of agony wash through him, over him, and it seems to work. The feeling begins to still within him. He lies there, limp on the sand for what seems like an eternity, letting the restless throb slowly quiet. He hurts everywhere, and the ghost of a thought drifts through his mind. Where am I? It floats, gossamer thin in the air, fluttering just beyond his reach. He takes another cautious breath and tentatively tries to raise his head, careful not to stir the lurking pain nestling inside his skull. Damp sand, like candied sugar crystals, sticks to his stubbled cheek as he shifts his weight up onto his aching forearms, cautiously testing the limit of their strength. He squints out into the morning light. How did I get here? Gulls skip across the sand as he searches the landscape for an answer, but nothing here looks familiar. Did something happen? He takes in the silent forest that backs the beach, its dark canopy beyond unreadable. No clues, no hook to hang understanding on. Okay, where was I before I was here? He looks up at the haunting grey vault of winter sky hanging overhead and wonders if he might be dreaming, if he might be in bed, safe at home, wherever that might be. But the clouds look back, heavy and full of rain. He shivers. It's only now that he notices his clothes are wet, their sodden fabric clammy against his skin. He shudders, cold to his damp bones. He must move, he knows that much. He must get warm or risk hypothermia in this weather. He looks back towards the trees that skirt the beach. The wind whips sharp needles of sand into his skin, tiny pinpricks against his numb flesh. He needs shelter. Struggling clumsily to his feet, he begins to process the extent of his injuries as each muscle is asked to move. Upright, he hesitates. He turns in a small circle, checking the sand around where he lay. A natural instinct telling him to look, nothing more. To look for things he may have lost. Belongings left behind. Although what those would be, he does not know. But then he must have some belongings, mustn't he? He pats his clothes for a second, before jabbing his numb hands into his wet pockets. There must be something. His pockets are empty. He's momentarily flummoxed into inaction. What the hell is going on? He runs a quick hand through his damp hair, trying to grapple back control of the situation, trying to wrangle the logic of it. He must remember, surely. His hand skims the back of his head and the throb of agony at the base of his skull washes over him again, pinching tight. He sucks in a sharp breath and whips away his hand to see the dark smear on his fingers. Blood. He squeezes his eyes shut, the throb rolling deep inside his skull. He breathes through the pain as it slowly subsides. When he opens his eyes, he notices something else on the other side of his hand. He turns his palm over, and there on the back, in blue ink, writing. A faint ink mark faded from the seawater, a word. He stares down at it, perplexed. Strange. What does it mean? Deep in his mind, the word dances on the tip of recollection. The answer so close, he could almost reach out and grasp it, but it rolls away, out of reach, evasive, mercurial, like the bright filaments that play on the inside of his eyelids each time he closes them. He shudders. The cold snaps him back to the immediate situation. It will come back, he tells himself. He gives himself a brisk shake and then starts to walk inland purposefully. Wet sand squelches up between his bare toes as he walks, cold and thick like poured concrete. All the while the tendrils of his brain search, delicately, for something to cling to. What was the last thing you remember? Silence. The sound of sea foam bubbling and popping as it dries in the wind. How did I end up here? Did something happen to me? Suddenly the realization hits him. He stops abruptly. Wait. Who am I? What's my name? He stands there frozen, his short brown hair tousled by the wind. His mind races. Where am I from? He can't remember. He looks down at the blood smeared across his hand, the word on the other side. The panic starts to rise now with incredible speed. Why can't I remember? Why can't I remember my name? The weight of what this means bears down on him. With each cold, snatched breath he takes, fear pumping through him, primal and quickening. Oh God, it's all gone. His world shrinks to a pinhead and then dilates so wide, suddenly terrifyingly borderless. He has no edges anymore. Who is he? He has no self. He feels the panic roaring inside him, escalating, his heart tripping faster. His mind frantically searches for something, anything to grab hold of, his eyes wildly scanning the landscape around him. But there's no escape from it. The void. He is here and there is no before. There are no answers. Thoughts thrumming, he fumbles to check his empty pockets again. Nothing. No ID, no phone, no wallet, no keys, nothing with a name on it, no way to find out. He tries to slow his breathing, to stay calm. He tries to think clearly. If something has happened, someone will find me and take me back to where I was before. Then I'll remember. Someone will know me. And everything will come back. It will be okay. I just need to find someone. He looks up, eyes finding the forest again. And the indent of a path. He sets off, his pace frenetic, in search of someone. Wait. He stops abruptly again, a jolt of self-preservation. Maybe you're out here alone for a reason. He studies the word written on his hand. It's all he has to go on, but it's not enough. Is it a reminder? A warning? Perhaps something very bad has happened. He thinks of his head wound. If he was attacked, being found wouldn't be the best idea, at least until he knows what happened, or who he is. He could still be in danger. It's impossible to tell yet. He commits the word on his hand to memory, and then rubs the ink away against his wet trousers until the mark is gone. He'll remember it. Best to cover the evidence in case he's found. A thought flexes itself deep inside his head, awakening. Something creeping on the edge of recollection. A memory, or the ghost of one. Just out of reach. Someone saying something to him. If he could only remember. Someone telling him something important. Something he needed to remember. Something he had to do. Suddenly it comes to him. Don't fuck it up. A memory. That's what they told him. But who exactly, he can't recall. He grasps at the memory. It's a warning, a threat, so strong and clear. Don't fuck it up. Don't fuck what up? Think. Think. He chases the thought, but it disappears out of sight. He notices his own bare feet beneath him on the sand. A thought surfaces. He remembers reading once that suicides often remove their shoes before killing themselves. Is he a suicide? How he knows the fact about the shoes, he does not know. Did he take off his shoes? Did he leave them and his things and his life in a tidy pile somewhere, abandoned? But why would he do that? He doesn't feel sad. He doesn't feel like the kind of person who would kill himself. But then maybe nobody ever does. Don't fuck it up is all he has to go on. But what if he already has? Another memory flashes out of the darkness, a burst of someone telling him something. You need to find her. Find her? He straightens. It's a crystal clear directive, a purpose. Is that why I'm here? To find someone? Who is she to me? He thinks of the word he removed from the back of his hand. Why do I need to find her? The memory is what it is. There is no more. Whoever she is, he needs to find her. They must have said more. He tries to force the memory, but the throb awakens deep at the base of his skull. He lets the thought go. All he knows is that he was told by someone, instructed by someone. He can't remember who told him, or what they sounded like, or their face. But he trusted them. He knows that much. How can he find her, this woman, if he doesn't know who or what he's looking for? A sound in the distance breaks the man's concentration. A voice calling out. Instinctively, he turns towards the forest, his heart pounding. There's no one there. The wind, perhaps, though it sounded more like someone calling a name. It came from the forest, a voice carrying over the wind. He stares long after the sound has gone, certain he heard it. Someone. But there is no one. He turns back to the water. The sound comes again, this time right behind him. It's a voice. He freezes. There's someone standing right behind him. He turns slowly on the wet sand. Someone is there. A young woman. She wasn't there before. Where did she come from? He blinks, trying desperately to make sense of what is happening, his thoughts racing. She wasn't there before, was she? Is this her? Is she the one I need to find? But in the same instant, he knows. It isn't her. He studies her as she stares at him. She is talking to him, her expression confused. She looks concerned, as if she may have been speaking for a while. She's saying something, words he can't quite understand. Her language garbled, the sense not apparent. His head throbs deeply. There's a look in her eyes, and everything he needs to know is in that look. He's safe for now. That's as clear to him as the sand and the cold and the bright high-vis yellow of the woman's coat. And suddenly, for a heartbeat, he understands exactly what is happening to him. That this has happened so many times before. This exact scene. That this is a loop he can never escape. He briefly understands a tiny part of what he needs to do next. And with that knowledge, panic crests in a giant wave over him, the bright pinch of pain in his skull exploding to life as he crumples onto the sand. Chapter 2. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 6. London. This is my pager. There are many like it, but this one is mine. Like a song I can't shake or an advert jingle, it runs through my head as I jog toward 10, the pager vibrating deep in my pocket in time. This is my pager. There are many like it, but this one is mine. I know, as mantras go, it's not original. But to be fair to all concerned, it only started out as a joke at medical school. And the joke became a habit, and weirdly, these days, it does actually calm me down. That's the thing about habits. They're comforting. They're hard to kick. Like smoking. And I don't do that one these days. I'm not that kind of girl anymore. Strictly speaking, I'm not a girl at all. I'm a 30-year-old woman. I'm the leading consultant neuropsychiatrist in a busy London hospital. If I ever actually left work, it wouldn't be Ms. on my restaurant reservation, it would be Doctor. If I ever had time to go to restaurants, that is. You have to watch out for habits in this job, when 12-hour shifts slide effortlessly into 24-hour shifts. But as habits go, there's nothing wrong with mantras. God, I need a cigarette. When I get to Ward 10, Mr. Davidson is yelling at the top of his 78-year-old lungs, which has the combined effect of being both disturbing and at the same time strangely sweet. But perhaps the main takeaway is its sheer volume. A visiting couple and a porter stand stock still in the hallway, heads cocked towards the commotion coming from his room. Their expressions settle when they clock my Doctor ID lanyard. It tends to have that effect. Over the years, I've noticed the doctor's lanyard tends to elicit either relief or apprehension. I flick off my angry pager and plop it back into its pocket. Doctors are some of the only people left in the world you're likely to see carrying pagers. We still use them because they're reliable. Unlike mobile phones, pagers don't have dead zones. They work everywhere, even on the heavily insulated X-ray wards of a hospital. And they don't run out of battery after a few hours. Pagers can run for over a week between charges. And they're durable. Throw them as hard as you possibly can against a concrete wall while crying, for example, and they just won't die. As I enter the room in question, I find a junior doctor, two agency nurses, and Mr. Davidson's 40-year-old son standing impotently by as the bedbound Mr. Davidson continues to shout, his voice quavering at the assembled group, tears rolling softly down his tired, crinkly face. All heads turn to me as I enter. The lanyard does its thing. The junior doctor throws me an imploring look, his expression telling me he'd be more than happy for me to take over. I give him a nod. This is, after all, why they paged me. Mr. Davidson's screaming and the general vibe of the room make it clear that an impasse has been reached. Mr. Davidson doesn't want to be touched or manhandled. "Good morning, Mr. Davidson," I say brightly, topping his energy. There's a slight break in the rhythm of his yells. He looks at me surprised, and I continue with his full attention. "My name is Dr. Lewis. Do you remember me, Mr. Davidson? I'm your doctor, Emma Lewis." I give him a reassuring smile, as if to say, "Of course you remember me. We're old friends." He clings to my smile, seduced from his train of thought, and his yelling finally ceases. He gives me a tentative nod, not fully invested in the idea that we know each other just yet. "Can you tell me what's wrong, Mr. Davidson?" His tear-stained face uncrumples as he struggles to unpick my question. "Are you in pain, Mr. Davidson? Where do you feel it?" I nudge him on. He looks away from me now towards the window. It's hard to tell to what extent Mr. Davidson recognizes me, or if he does at all. Mr. Davidson has problems accessing and storing memory. I've been treating him for 3 weeks since he was admitted. Recognition is a complex neurological process, and humans are very, very good at masking the absence of it. People adapt around memory losses. They rely on other things like visual cues and social cues. They get good at reading people. Situations. They find ways around things until an answer presents itself. But regardless of whether Mr. Davidson recognizes me, he trusts me. He stops shouting, and that is definitely progress. I approach his bed cautiously. He turns to look up at me with big, wet eyes, curious, exhausted. I gently place a hand on his arm as reassurance. He peers down at my hand, his chest rising and falling as he fights to get his breath back to normal. He doesn't pull away from my touch. He doesn't lash out. Patients with memory disorders can often become uncharacteristically aggressive, physically violent. But when his gaze floats back up to me, it isn't hostile. It's entreating. Where exactly are you feeling the pain, Mr. Davidson? I ask again, softly. He takes in air in great heaves. Not a huge surprise. He's been yelling continuously at the top of his voice for quite a while to a confused and frankly deeply concerned audience. As he stares up at me, gulping in snatched breaths, he looks like a man lost in a foreign country. He taps his chest. His heart. That's my answer. The answer to my question, that's where he feels the pain. In his heart. I nod and give his arm another gentle squeeze. I understand. Mr. Davidson nods back solemnly. Good. And promptly bursts into a cataclysm of coughs. There's nothing wrong with his heart. Well, not physically, anyway. What's physically wrong with Howard Davidson is his brain. As far as Howard is concerned, he's a 32-year-old man trapped inside the body of a 78-year-old. He woke up 3 weeks ago with no memory of the last 46 years of his life. In his mind, he left the house in 1973 and woke up here, an old man. What's wrong with Howard Davidson is visible only on a scan. Large sections of his neocortex have atrophied, died. All the memories stored in those areas are gone. A huge portion of his life, to his mind, never happened. 3 weeks ago he was fine, pottering around his garden, walking his dog, reading, deep in the flow of his own life, enjoying his retirement. But that old man is gone now. Howard Davidson was found wandering down the central reservation of a dual carriageway in Shepherd's Bush and brought to the emergency room. After we ascertained from his relatives that he had no history of Alzheimer's, that up until that morning he had apparently been quite happily enjoying the life of a retired MP, an MRI scan was taken. The atrophy present in the brain scan was found to be indicative of vascular dementia, specifically single infarct dementia. A single stroke had instantly killed off a massive portion of his hippocampus. 46 years of life erased in the blink of an eye. He has no memory of having had children or running for office, and he still believes he lives with his young wife, Ginny, near Goldhawk Road. All long-term memories end there. I pour him a glass of water from the jug beside his bed. He takes it with a shaky hand. Then I turn to face the ragtag lineup behind me, looking for some kind of explanation for Mr. Davidson's current state, although I already have my suspicions. His son catches my eye. Simon Davidson and I have met before, briefly, on the day Howard was admitted. I'll let you in on a secret, they tell us at medical school. Some things can't be fixed. Some things must be lived with, adapted to. Simon Davidson didn't want to hear that. I've been in this profession long enough to trust my instincts in situations like this, and right now my instincts are telling me that Simon is almost definitely the issue at fault here. Doctors and nurses don't tend to make grown men cry. Well, not in a professional setting at any rate. So I give the medical team a nod, and they shuffle gratefully out past Simon. Simon, would it be possible to talk to you outside briefly? Simon's eyes widen slightly at being the only person singled out. Yes, sure. He gives me a pragmatic nod and starts to leave. I'll be right with you in 1 minute. I offer him a reassuring smile as he pushes out the door, frowning and unconvinced. However, I need to settle Mr. Davidson, my actual patient, before I can deal with his son. I watch the door softly puff closed behind him. Who is that horrible young man? The voice comes shakily from behind me. I turn and take in Mr. Davidson's frail form, his crumpled features, his kind eyes. I feel an ache of sadness in my chest. He means his son, of course. But the thing that really gets me is the caution with which he asks the question. The caution for me, in case he offends me, in case the horrible man is a friend of mine. It's all right, Howard. It's just me and you now, I reassure him. I move back to the bed and take his delicate wrist in my hand, counting off his pulse. Elevated, but fine. Did the man who was just in here upset you, Howard? I know the answer already. This isn't the first time this has happened since Mr. Davidson's been here. Not by any means. Nor is he the first patient who's reacted in this way. Howard Davidson shifts to sit a little higher in the bed. That young man. Not the other doctor. The small man. He told me that Ginny had died. My wife. Ginny. And I don't know who he was, or why he'd say a thing like that. I mean, why would he say it? He studies my face, a fallen toddler, unsure yet whether to laugh or cry. And the way he said it was so strange, just, she's dead. Plain and simple. When I asked when she'd get here, just like that, like it was nothing. My Ginny, dead. He thumps his fingers against his chest. He's agitated again at the memory. Why would he say that? He peers up at me, watery eyes panicked. Ginny's okay, isn't she? She was fine when I left the house. The other doctor wouldn't tell me. She's all right, isn't she? I should have never left the house. His frail hands become fists now on the bedsheets. Ginny died 11 years ago, at 62, from thyroid cancer. To be fair to Howard's son, he was probably just trying to remind his father, but no doubt would have done so in that slightly weary way people tend to reiterate facts to dementia patients. Is Ginny all right? Muscle tremors flutter under his eyes. He's tired. I take his hand lightly. Yes, Ginny's perfect, Howard. She's very good. She sends her love, and she told me to tell you that she can't make it in this afternoon, but she will see you first thing tomorrow. I say it because he's my patient, and it will make him feel really good. And he won't remember I said it tomorrow. He smiles and squeezes my hand as hard as he can, eyes filling. Thank you. Thank you. I was so worried about her. I don't know what I would do without my Ginny. And if I didn't even get a chance to say goodbye, well... Of course, he did get a chance to say goodbye. 11 years ago. At her bedside. In this very hospital. Mr. Davidson will not be able to remember the words of this conversation. But he will remember the feelings it brings up. I'm not lying to him. I'm just not being an arsehole. We can't inform Howard that his wife is dead every time he asks us. It would be beyond cruelty. Why repeat the worst day of this man's life every day of his life? Outside in the hallway, I try to explain this to his defensive son. Are you suggesting we're supposed to lie to him every day until he dies? Simon's voice is low, but the tone is harsh. This isn't a discussion for a corridor, but I don't think any venue would sweeten what I'm about to say. You just have to ask yourself, Simon, who exactly would benefit from his remembering your mother's death? Why are you so keen on making your father remember that one event? He stares at me, blindsided by the questions, confused by the subversion of the customer is always right rule he assumed also operated in hospitals. He swallows whatever vitriol he was about to say and replies simply, I want him to remember it because it's true. It's important he remembers it because it's true. Yes, it is true, Simon, but lots of things are true. I could theoretically walk up to oncology right now and tell everyone up there that 90% of them definitely aren't going to make it, but what on earth would be the clinical benefit of that? Your father isn't going to get any better. He won't remember these things, no matter how often you tell him. It will only upset him. And if you tell him, he will hate you, Simon. He may live another 15 or even 20 years. He may outlive us all. I think we'd both like his remaining years to be happy ones. I'd advise you to let your sister take over as next of kin from now on, and to limit your visits if you're not happy with what I'm recommending. And if you do insist on continuing to visit your father, I'm going to have to ask you to stop deliberately agitating and upsetting him. He's a vulnerable adult, and what you're doing is bordering on psychological abuse. As harsh as that may sound, Howard is my patient. It's his welfare I'm here to safeguard, not his son's. Simon glares at me for a second before he replies. I see, he says finally. Well, obviously, I hadn't realised I was causing him so much distress. People don't want the truth from us doctors. Not really. They may think they do, but they don't. People want doctors to be like priests. They want hope delivered with authority. I catch sight of a nurse waving over to me from the nurse's station. She gestures to a phone receiver at her ear. I suggest family counselling to Simon and say goodbye. At the nurse's station, I'm handed the phone with a rallying smile. On to the next.
Hi, Emma.
The voice on the other end of the line is my secretary, Millie.
Sorry to chase you around the building, but there was a phone call earlier from the US. I told them you were on a call and they said they'd call back at 1:30. And I haven't seen you since, so I thought I should let you know.
I look down at my wristwatch. 8:27. I can make it back to neuropsychiatry in that time. At a jog. Who was it, Millie?
A man named Richard Groves, Dr. Groves.
I frown at her down the line. Richard Groves? That can't be right, are you sure?
That's definitely what he said his name was.
She says it with mild disinterest. I can hear her continuing to type as she talks. The Richard Groves. The line goes silent for a second.
I don't know, Emma, sorry. He just said his name and I wrote it down. Why? Who is he?
I momentarily consider explaining who he is to Millie, then think better of it. She wouldn't have nearly the right reaction if I told her who Richard Groves was. If she Googled him, which I'm absolutely certain she won't, she'd see a career spanning 30 years at the forefront of neuroscience. She'd see bestsellers, essays, university placements, corporate and political consultancies, resulting in new tech, new procedures, new government policies. If she Googled my actual job title, which again, she wouldn't, but if she did Google the word neuropsychiatrist, Richard Groves's name would come up in the Wikipedia notable section. Mine would not. Well, not yet. Okay, did he say at least what he was calling about, Millie? I hear the rustle of papers.
No, he didn't.
I have met Richard Groves twice. The last time, briefly 3 years ago, at a medical conference networking session in Dubai. I wrote my thesis on him and I have disagreed with some of his methods. But that's what medical papers do. That's the scientific method right there. He was affable when we met, collegial. But I wouldn't say we were quite on telephone chatting terms. Out of the blue doesn't even begin to describe this phone call. Why the hell is he calling me from America at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning? It's a question I'm pretty sure Millie won't have the answer to. I look at my watch again. 2 minutes now. I can make it, if I run. Chapter 3. The Man. Day 1. People arrive.
This is Bravo 7 for Sierra 43. Sierra 43, proceed immediately to car park at Holcombe Beach. Report of suspicious behaviour. IC1, white, male, 30s to 40s, approximately 6 foot, dark clothing, erratic behaviour. Elderly caller has eyes on suspect and has been advised not to approach.
Static. Received Bravo 7, Sierra 43 en route. Go ahead, over. Static.
Non-urgent call, but proceed with caution. Suspect may be under the influence or possible mental health issues. Appears to be in some distress. No visible weapons, but potential suicide risk, over.
Static. Received Bravo 7, Sierra 43 proceeding to location. On our way. Out. 15 minutes later, the patrol car is the only car in the beach car park. The long stretch of ochre shingle, usually packed with vehicles during the holidays, is now abandoned, deserted for the winter season. The officers, one female, one male, get out of the car. The slam of doors the only sound as their breath hangs in warm clouds in the post-dawn air. They crunch their way out towards the beach path. The female officer slides up the zipper of her fluorescent high-vis coat, a sharp slice of colour cutting through the drab forest. The path opens, its gravel giving way to the boardwalk over the reed marshes that connects the forest and the beach. Ahead, the vast expanse of Holcombe Beach rolls out before them. An elderly man stands waiting on the blustery peak of a steep sand dune, and they cross the soft sand to meet him. Their approach catches his eye and he turns, waving his umbrella to draw attention. He shouts something down to them, but his words are lost in the wind. The female police officer throws a look to the male officer, who drops back almost imperceptibly as she takes the lead. As they reach the dune's crest, the full extent of the beach rises into view, the long, flat sweep towards the breaking waves and the North Sea. It's choppy out there today. The two officers can make out his words now over the wind, mid-sentence.
Don't know what's wrong. I asked, but I can't seem to get through to him. He just kept going. He's gone down there now.
The old man throws an arm up towards the east, and the officer's eyes follow his motion down the beach.
Over there. Do you see?
In the distance, a receding figure, walking away. Alone on the empty beach, in no particular hurry.
I told them on the phone already, the old man continues. No way I could stop him, you see. Had to come up here just to get a mobile phone signal anyway. Terrible reception out here. I told him to wait, somebody would be here soon, but he just kept going. Not sure if he even heard what I was saying. There's something wrong with him. I don't know, he's not in good shape at all, soaking wet for a start. And on a day like this...
The female police officer turns away from the figure on the beach, back to the old man. She takes him in. A smartly dressed early riser on his morning walk, paper under arm, umbrella, raincoat, hat. He's prepared for the weather, his cheeks ruddy in the cold.
Did you make the call yourself, sir? She asks.
I did. I didn't think anything of him until he got closer. Some mornings there are other walkers out this early, especially on the weekends, but when he got closer I saw something wasn't quite right, and I thought I should say something, he persists. You know, just in case.
Just in case? The female officer asks, her curiosity piqued.
He needed help, he clarifies.
The female officer looks down at the tracks in the sand below the dune slope, a line of bare footprints leading all the way back to the West Cove, perhaps 2 miles, certainly as far as the eye can see. She looks east, out towards the walking figure in the distance. He has no shoes. Then, as if on cue, as if he can feel her eyes on his back, the figure stops. He stands there, motionless, letting the wind roar around him, his wet clothes slapping heavily against him. And then he drops, half collapsing, half sitting onto the wet sand. The male officer turns to the female officer, touches her sleeve. She gives him a nod and then turns back to the old man.
Sir, this is Officer Poole, and he's going to take a statement from you about what's happened. Are you okay with that?
The old man nods,
The male officer retrieves a slim black notebook from his utility pocket, flips it open, and begins. Officer Paul's questions fade out of hearing in the wind as the female police officer moves off in the direction of the sitting man. A series of thoughts flicker across her face as she walks out across the sands. She depresses the button on her radio.
This is Sierra 4-3. We're at the scene. I have eyes on the suspect. I see one, approximately 6 foot, dark clothing. East Holcomb Beach. Suspect has no shoes. I'm approaching with caution.
She continues to close the wide gulf between them, the sand twirling in tiny whirlwinds between her and him. There's something surreal about the scene. It makes her think of the past. There's something gothic about it, she decides. Something expansive. And for some reason, the start of Great Expectations springs into her mind. A convict washed up in the marshes. Without a second thought, she pulls her radio up again, depresses the button.
Bravo 7, this is Sierra 4-3. Can we run a check on HMP Burr? Anyone unaccounted for? Let me know. Suspect may be a missing person, over.
It's just a feeling, nothing more. An instinct. But she knows sometimes instincts are right.
Her radio crackles to life loudly.
Acknowledge Sierra 4-3. Running prison check now, stand by, over.
He doesn't turn at the sound. She's closer now, she can see his clothes, soaking wet, just as the old man said. His body shuddering, struggling to maintain core temperature and failing. The early stages of hypothermia.
Sir?
She shouts, trying to lift her voice over the howling wind, but the wind throws it back in her face. Still, the figure does not turn. She's close now. Close enough to see the rise and fall of the man's shoulders, the shallow pant of his breathing in the icy air. She pauses.
The radio on her chest bursts loud with static again.
Sierra 4-3, be advised, that is a negative. Repeat, a negative on HMP Burr. All accounted for at Burr Prison. Advise, over.
The figure before her still does not move. He does not appear to hear, as her fingers fumble to silence the radio. She moistens her lips, makes another assessment. The suspect is not responding. He has no visible weapons, but could possibly have a concealed one, though where he might be hiding it, she does not know. His clothes are loose and wet, clinging to his chest and arms. He could have hypothermia already. He could be in shock. His behaviour could be erratic. It would be possible for her to overpower him for the short amount of time necessary for Officer Poole to make up the distance across the beach between them, should she need to, in the unlikely event that the suspect becomes violent. She proceeds, with caution.
Sir?
A movement. His back muscles tense at the sound of her voice. He can hear her. That much is clear.
Hello, sir? Can you hear me, sir?
He does not respond.
Bit of a cold morning for a swim, isn't it? Why don't we head somewhere warm?
He remains motionless, his back to her.
Can I ask what exactly you're doing, sir?
The distance between them fills with the roar of the wind and waves. She makes a decision and moves in a wide semicircle up the beach until she has an angle on the man's face. He's looking out at the sea, his face slack, tension around his eyes lost in thought. It certainly looks like he's in shock, in which case, whatever has happened to him has already happened. This is the aftermath of something. Whether he's the victim or the perpetrator remains uncertain.
Sir, I'm going to need you to respond to me. Can you do that?
He doesn't answer. Tricky, she thinks. They usually run at you or away from you at this point. Either they're being chased by you or rescued by you. She can't tell which she's doing here. The other shoe usually drops at this point. But he has no shoes, she notes.
Sir, I'm going to need you to look at me.
He briefly glances away in the other direction, as if he hears something in the distance. She tries again.
Sir, I'm going to need you to turn around.
He turns, calmly, and looks straight at her. His features are striking, though softened with age. An attractive man in his late 30s or early 40s, she guesses. She takes in his thick, dark hair, his brown eyes, the shadow of stubble across his jaw, sprinkled with the first signs of grey. Then their eyes lock, and the sounds of the beach around them seem to fade away, a bubble forming around them, a connection. There's something odd in the way he looks at her. When questioned afterwards, she'll struggle to accurately articulate how this look made her feel. But after some thought, she'll settle on the adjective peculiar. A calm descends over them, like being underwater, like falling through the air together, like a dream. A gull shrieks, and the female officer's attention flicks up and away for a fraction of a second. But the spell is broken. She looks back just in time to see the man's eyes flutter as he slumps softly down onto the wet sand, unconscious. Oh, shit, she mutters, her words once again lost in the wind. Her eyes dart up the beach to where Officer Poole and the old man stand, both dumbly staring back. It is Officer Poole who starts running first, sand flying out behind him. She snaps back into action, diving forward and moving the huddled body into a recovery position, gently adjusting his head and freeing his airways, her hands coming away streaked with slick, wet smears of blood. A head wound. Officer Poole stumbles to a halt over her. What happened? He pants. She looks up at him, depressing the buttons of her radio, pulling it towards her mouth by way of explanation. This is Officer Graceford, come in, over. She eyes Officer Poole as she waits. Check for ID, she prompts him. The radio crackles to life.
Receive, Graceford, go ahead, over.
Poole is on his knees now, his hands urgently searching the man's body, probing pockets for identification. Graceford speaks quickly and clearly into the radio. We have a medical emergency on Holcombe Beach, Easton. Closest access point, Holcombe Car Park. Requesting immediate medical assistance, over. Poole shakes his head. No ID. No bag. Nothing. Graceford depresses the button again. Assistance required for unidentified white male, late 30s to 40s, unconscious. Potential head injury. Initial assessment indicates early stages of hypothermia and shock. Unclear if drug-related. Please advise. Over. Static.
Sierra 43, be advised. Paramedics are en route from King's Lynn. ETA 8-10. Are you able to administer first aid on site? Over.
Poole nods to Graceford and starts to remove his jacket. He throws it to her and immediately sets about unlacing his work boots.
Yes, yes, we're administering basic first aid on site, she says into the radio. ETA acknowledged, dispatch. We're trying to keep him warm out here, but do not advise moving at this stage.
Receive, Graceford. Stand by.
Graceford clips her radio away with numb fingers and shrugs off her own coat now. She shifts the unconscious man onto it and places Poole's coat over him. Officer Poole, having removed his boots, begins to remove his socks, too, one bare foot dancing on the cold sand to keep his balance. Gingerly, he thrusts each of the unconscious man's feet into his still warm socks. Next, Graceford tosses Poole his own discarded boots, which he pulls on the end of each limp leg. Poole looks down at his watch. That's 5 minutes. Another 3 to 5 to wait. Now coatless and shoeless, he rubs his hands together briskly to warm them. Graceford nods. She releases the man's wrist. Pulse is fine. Poole scans the horizon. 360 degrees. Nothing. Nothing but the fading form of the old man on his way home.
What do you think this is, then?
He asks Graceford.
Hard to say. She looks pensive. No ID. No shoes. He could have wandered off from the hospital, maybe. I checked with dispatch about Burr Prison. That was my first thought, but the prisoners are all accounted for there. It could be drugs. Mental health problem. What was he saying to you? Nothing. Nothing at all. Which was weird. You think failed suicide? He studies her blank face. She looks down at the silent body. He's soaking wet, so definitely went in the water, for whatever reason. Either he planned to get out again or he didn't. But I don't see a towel. Paul looks down at his own feet, now turning blue. Well, it's fucking freezing, I know that much. He gestures towards the dunes leading back to the car park. Shall I go over and meet the ambulance crew there? They should be here any minute. Yeah, you go. Once they pick him up, we'll sweep the area, see what we can find. ID, shoes, clothes, wallet. He must have had a bag or something. He'll be here somewhere. He couldn't have got here without it. Paul nods and heads off before suddenly turning back. He raises his voice to shout over the wind. Unless he didn't get here by land, he might have got here by sea, if you know what I mean. Without waiting for an answer, he shrugs and sets off at a jog back in the direction of the car park. Graceford looks down at the wet man, his ribs rising and falling. Maybe Paul is right, she thinks. Maybe he came off a boat. Another figure rises into view over the top of the dunes, unseen at first. This figure is not a paramedic. He is not wearing a high-vis vest. He carries a camera in one hand, its neck strap dangling loosely above the wispy dune grass. Oh, shit, Graceford whispers to herself as she sees him. She rises quickly to her feet, takes a deep breath and shouts as loud as she can, her chest aching against the noise of the wind. She shouts in the hope that Paul will hear her. Get him off the fucking beach, Chris! At the top of the mound, Mike Redman doesn't catch Graceford's words, but he catches her tone. He pauses. He takes in the tableau stretching out before him. Graceford, bent over a crumpled form, surrounded by miles of empty rolling sand. Beautiful. A barefooted Paul, sprinting tragicomically towards him. Mouth wide, mid-shout. Perfect. Redman raises his camera and starts to shoot. Over the clacking of the shutter, the whisper of a siren wails over the wind into audibility. Chapter 4. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 6. The phone call. I burst into my empty office, fumble on the lights, and grab the receiver halfway through the third ring. Hello? It comes out louder and more flustered than I had anticipated. I feel a hot blush steep through my cheeks, even though I'm the only person in the room. I've essentially just shouted at the world's most preeminent neuroscientist. Happy Monday, Emma. You're doing a sterling job. There's a brief pause on the other end of the line before the caller regroups.
Hello? Am I speaking to Dr. Lewis?
The voice has the warm hum of an American accent.
This is Richard Groves, calling for Dr. Lewis. May I speak with her?
Yes, sorry, Dr. Groves. Yes, it is, yes, Dr. Lewis speaking. Complete gibberish. I take a second, cover the receiver, and try to catch my breath from three flights of stairs and too many busy corridors. Sorry that I missed your first call, Richard. I wasn't available earlier. It's a bit crazy here at the moment. Well, always, actually. But you know what it's like, I suppose. I bury a groan in my free hand. Oh, God, I should have thought about what I might actually say when I answered the phone. Bugger. But rich laughter greets me from the other end of the line.
That I do, Emma, that I do. Not to worry. I've got you now, and that's all that matters.
I raise my head from my hand. The voice is kind. There's a calm authority to it. And it's a voice I recognise very well from the brief times we've met, and of course from his TED Talks and audiobooks. There's something instantly reassuring about it. I realise he's stopped talking. How can I help, Richard? I move a box of case notes from my office chair and sit down hard into its puffed leather. He clears his throat, suddenly businesslike.
Well, here's the thing, Emma. Is it okay if I call you Emma, or do you prefer Dr. Lewis?
No, Emma, it's fine. Now I realise that I've already called him Richard, and I didn't even ask.
That's great, Emma. Okay, so I'll cut to the chase. The last time we met was...
In Dubai? I cringe at the thought. Oh, God.
Yes, that conference on advances in neuropsychiatry, I think. We spoke about retrograde amnesia and psychogenic amnesia, fugue, a misdiagnosis and testing methods.
Yes, we did. We spoke about memory loss and psychological trauma. We spoke about misdiagnosis. I feel the back of my neck flush hot because I know what's coming. I push on regardless. Yes, that's right. I think it was in regards to my paper.
Yes, it was.
He agrees, and I hear a smile in his voice. His recollection of events is obviously amusing him. Thank bloody God for that. Our conversation in Dubai was the second time we had met, and it had gone pretty well in comparison to the first time we met. The first time we met, he was giving a lecture on the neurobiology of amnesia at Stanford. I'd received a research grant, and I'd used the opportunity to travel to the US to hear the talk and try to arrange to meet him in person to clarify some points about the cases he'd worked on. Now, to be fair to myself, I was young. I still had the idea that confrontational debate in an educational setting was a productive method of getting anything at all done, which it turns out is not, in fact, true. And on top of that, it turned out that I had also sort of misunderstood the tone of the evening. So when the Q&A finally opened out to the audience, it would be fair to say that as I lowered my shaky hand and started to ask the first of my three questions, I was not greeted with quite the professional curiosity that I had naively expected from Groves's 800-seat auditorium of paying guests. I feel the cringe twang again deep inside me. Listen, Richard, can I just say again, I am so sorry for what happened at Stanford. I can't even... He's chuckling now. Oh, God. Somehow that makes it worse. What a lovely man.
Emma, I told you the last time we met is fine. I mean, I wish we discussed your questions in a more private setting, but heck, that's the nature of medicine, right? You've got to be able to question things. Anyway, put it out of your mind for now.
I hear the receiver pull away slightly at his end of the line and a muffled yawn.
Sorry, Emma.
Groves continues.
It's not you. You'll have to excuse me, but I'm on Eastern time. It's 2:32 in the morning here in Massachusetts, long past my bedtime.
He gives a tired chuckle, warm and throaty.
We're pulling an all-nighter in the lab, so I thought, why not call you in England at a decent hour while I'm still up anyway?
I realize it's still Sunday night where he is. He's pulling an all-nighter on a Sunday. Jesus, the Americans work hard. Monday morning in London suddenly feels infinitely more manageable. Well, I'm glad you called. So, what is it I can do for you, Richard? Even as I say it, I wonder if there genuinely is anything I could help him with. It seems unlikely. Unless, of course, he needs someone to embarrass him publicly at another upcoming function. I hear him sigh heavily.
Emma, I really hate all this. You see, I'm usually a plan-ahead man. I'm not a fan of changes to my schedule. Snap decisions, that sort of thing. I suppose it's quite an old-fashioned way of working, but it's what I'm used to. So, I apologize if you're the same, but I'm afraid the reason I'm calling is all quite seat-of-the-pants. Anyway, to cut to the chase, I got a call this morning, my morning, from the UK, about a patient over there. And it made me think of you. Sorry, just one moment.
He breaks off. There's a scratch of something being pressed against the receiver mouthpiece on his end. I notice I'm standing up. I'm not sure when that happened. I wait. I look at my grey office door, the grey slat blinds, the neat piles of green patient folders on my desk. Then his voice comes back on the line like warm honey.
My apologies. The natives are restless here. Where was I?
You got a call and you thought of me, I prompt, sitting back down.
Yes. So I got a call from Peter Chorley at Cambridge. Do you know Chorley?
I rack my brains, but I feel like I would remember a Peter Chorley if I ever met one. No, I don't think I do. No.
He's got tenure, head of neurolinguistics at Cambridge. No background in our field, but he does a lot of advisory stuff, freelance over in the UK. Government consultancy, initiatives, boards, that sort of thing. A jack of all trades, to some extent. Anyway, he rang to gauge my interest on working on a patient over there in England. He thought it would be exactly my kind of thing, but as you can tell, I'm pretty swamped up here. So, long story short, I suggested you.
I clutch the phone hard, as if it might suddenly and inexplicably be yanked from me, my breath catching in my throat. Oh my God. Richard continues.
You're there already, you know your stuff, it's a small field, and this is exactly what you've been after. Am I right?
He asks triumphantly. A man doing someone a solid favour. I genuinely cannot believe this is happening. Is all I manage.
It's an intriguing case, I promise you. You'll love it.
He adds encouragingly. And I'm absolutely certain I will love it, but that's not the problem. The problem is I'm pretty sure Richard Groves has made a mistake and dialed the wrong number. I try and think if there are any other neuropsychiatrists who, A, look like me, or B, have names similar to mine. He must be trying to get hold of someone else, surely. Things like this don't happen. Or at least, they don't happen to me. But then, neuropsychiatry isn't a huge field, especially in the UK, especially when it comes to specialists in memory. And now that I really think about it, I might be one of the few British specialists who's actually had the balls to introduce themselves to Groves and spoken to him in person. We neuropsychiatrists don't tend to get out much. Precious work time does tend to eat into any available extraneous social time. So perhaps I am pretty high on his list of options after all. But who am I kidding? I pushed for this, didn't I? I pushed so hard for this chance. Every time I met Groves, I've pushed. I talked, I listened, I hung on his every word. I basically low-level stalked him for this opportunity. I foisted my diagnostic theories down his throat at every juncture. And I sure as hell never saw anyone else pushing through the crowds to get to him to debate diagnostic methodology. God knows no one's pushed to be at the forefront of his mind more than I have. So maybe it isn't so strange. Perhaps, in a way, I chose him.
I know it might seem a shot out of the blue, Emma, but you've been on my radar for a while now. You know how rare these cases are, and you were over there. I could have called Tom Lister or John Radcliffe. He's not as, shall we say, invested as you are in new research. Let's be straight. You've got ideas, theories. I've read your research material, but you haven't had a proper stab at a fugue case yet. And you were right about brain imaging. We should have used it. Every case should. It should have been used to rule out or verify fugue. If I'd had the tech 20 years ago, I'd have been shouting at doctors in lecture halls, too. It's what I'd use myself now, and I know for damn sure is what you'll use.
He gives a youthful laugh.
Listen, I know you're busy over there. You've got your own thing going on in London, and it'd mean traveling north, uprooting for a while. But I really think this could be the opportunity that you've been after. I wouldn't be where I am today if someone hadn't taken a shot on me. And this is me giving you yours. What do you say?
He leaves the question hanging in the air, an ocean between us. Richard Groves has read my work. Of course he has. He's a fucking genius. I bet he reads everything. But he liked it. He agrees with it. It's right.
I'm right. I peer up at the anemic grey of the ceiling tiles above me. Somehow there's a coffee stain up there. I have no idea what he's suggesting me for yet, but whatever it is, I should definitely do it. I'd be crazy not to. What's the case, Richard? I ask, grabbing a pen and a stack of post-its from the desk. His tone is enthusiastic.
Mr. Nobody,
he says. My pen hovers over the post-it paper, expecting more, but nothing comes. Sorry? What was that, Richard? Mr...
I know, it's ridiculous, as usual. The press are calling him Mr. Nobody. He's the guy they found on the beach the other week. The one in the news?
He pauses expectantly once more, waiting for some kind of acknowledgement from me, but I'm still in the dark. I suppose now might be a good time to tell him that I don't really watch the news. I mean, I hardly have time to do my own laundry, and the last thing I want to do with the little free time I do have is fill it with problems I can't solve. The most I read is the free paper on the underground on the way to work, and I only skim that. Perhaps, in this case, though, a little TV could have gone a long way. Oops. I depress the computer's power button as stealthily as I can and swivel my chair and the phone away from its burst of startup noises. Google will be able to fill me in. Yes, I think I saw something. I fudge as the home screen settles, but he clearly sees through my delay tactics.
Okay. I'm guessing you haven't seen it. Let me give you the potted history. I'll get the exact location details to you, but he's in England. It's a coastal town outside London, but diagnosis-wise, at this stage, it's looking like retrograde amnesia or dissociative fugue.
He pauses to let that information sink in. Retrograde amnesia or fugue. The loss of all stored episodic memory, biographical memory, through trauma, be it physical or psychological. Patients with either would retain all skill-based, procedural and knowledge-based memory, as these types of memories are stored in different areas of the brain, but lose personal memory. A patient would know, for example, what the idea of home is, but he wouldn't remember his. He'd remember how to drive a car, but not where he usually parked it. His past would be a blank slate, remembering nothing of his life before the physical or psychological trauma that caused the amnesia. Like walking into a room and forgetting why, except you also don't know where the room is or where you were before you walked into it. Retrograde amnesia is caused by physical damage to the brain, and it's very, very rare. But fugue is even rarer. And unlike retrograde amnesia, fugue is caused solely by psychological trauma. I suddenly understand why Richard Groves is calling me in particular. In my thesis, I argued Groves may have misdiagnosed certain fugue cases. I stuck my head out over the parapet of recent graduation and criticised the received wisdom, challenging the established method, and arguing publicly that historically most few cases were likely misdiagnosed. He's offering me a chance. A chance to prove it. I take a deep breath. I see. There's silence on the other end of the line. I realise he wants me to ask the most important question of all, the nub of the matter. Which do you think it is, Richard? Retrograde or fugue? I ask carefully. We both know how important the distinction is. If this is a genuine fugue case, it could give invaluable insight into an extremely rare condition. We've only really been able to test for it since the 1990s, which means study cases are few and far between.
I haven't seen any scans yet,
Richard answers cautiously.
What they're telling me sounds intriguing. It isn't presenting as malingering, and it wouldn't have got this far if it was. especially in light of the oversights on the Piano Man case. People are very keen to spot that kind of thing early. I have it on very cynical authority from Chorley that we're dealing with something much more complex here. The powers that be over there seem pretty eager not to fuck the situation up. Yes, it's definitely fair to say they don't want another Piano Man situation.
It suddenly occurs to me how big a deal this case could be. If I take it, I won't just be treating an extremely rare RA fugue patient. I'll be responsible for averting another NHS diagnostic shitshow, because that's exactly what the Piano Man case was. 10 years ago, another man was found. This time in Sheppey, the Isle of Sheppey in Kent, an off-season seaside town. He was soaking wet and wandering along a coastal road in an evening suit. He had no identification on him. The labels had been cut out of his shirt and suit. Admitted to the local hospital, he seemed unable to speak to the doctors, and after neurological testing and psychiatric evaluation, he was diagnosed as fugue. Given a sketch pad, the man drew a detailed picture of a grand piano on a spotlit stage. When the staff took him to the piano in the hospital's chapel, he played the whole of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata from memory, and he was dubbed the Piano Man. The Piano Man's procedural memory was perfect. He remembered how to play, in spite of the fact that he'd lost all personal memory. The hospital staff encouraged him to play daily in the hope that it would help his recovery and trigger memory recall. Staff and patients would gather at the back of the chapel to listen, enthralled as the music flowed out of him from who knew where. Inevitably, the press got hold of the story. A photo circulated of the lost-looking man in the hospital's garden, in his formal evening suit,